Mondays and Tuesdays are UA and GPSA.
Yeah.
Wednesdays are general. Well, anyways, the time is now 4:35. Don't think we have a quorum. I'm calling this meeting to order. So first off, welcome and thank you for joining us. This is our last meeting before the Thanksgiving break. So considering once we get going, I'm not sure we'll have time, but want to wish everyone a happy and safe Thanksgiving. We'll have one more meeting at the end of the last week of the semester, which will be a wrap-up to look at to hopefully square away the UHRB staffing processes. And then also we're hoping to hear from the administrative and hearing interview board chairs of the university hearing interview boards. We've been trying to, in terms of looking at when we how we can handle it without, in essence, something that we can handle that's relatively self-contained. It seems to be prudent because starting something the week before exams, the week before everyone goes on break, would seem to be duplicative. That being said, the first item on our formal agenda is approval of the minutes. First up is November 1st, 2017. Yes. Michelle?
There's only one change that I have, and I'll give it to the clerk. It should be severity or pervasiveness or speech plus action on page 3, number 3. So it just says of, and it changes from meaning, so I just want to make sure that gets clarified.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Is it the typo we don't miss, so we don't need to vote on it. Also, actually, I would also apologize to those in the info listserv. There were issues with our listservs the past couple of days, actually. Jeremy would know this because I'm sure he's been involved with the server farm process potentially melting down. So some emails have been slow in getting out, so you have my apologies for that.
Should be on the up and up now.
Yes, so. It looks like everything. I got a whole bunch of emails that came through all at once, and I said, it looks like some stuff got unstuck. But that being said, is there anything else on the minutes of November 1st? Hearing none, there's no speakers, let's the chair put the question. All in favor of approving the minutes of November 1st, please raise your hand or placard. All who are opposed, and all who would like to abstain. The chair abstains by vote 5-0-1. The minutes are approved. Next up on our agenda is the minutes of November 7th. Are there any comments, questions, or concerns about the minutes of November 7th? Hearing none.
Actually, yeah.
Yes.
So since we're dealing with matters on the record, I think it's worth commenting on Mr. Kaufman, the chair of the University Assembly's comment, and your comments were on the lack of attendance. I think I would like you, as long as we're putting these words on the record, I will motion to amend the record to reflect the fact that this was a meeting not at our regularly scheduled time.
There's a motion to do so. I would imagine we would note that as a at some point. How can we note that? Maybe at the top. Under A, we can do that.
Sure.
So in essence, noting
this week.
No, it is better. It was reference having been at the meeting. It was in reference to that this semester there have been some members have been very, very attentive and prompt and very, the word is escaping me, but since people are involved and dutiful in their attendance, other members have not. So obviously those who are here are the ones who are not the issue. But we will then add something. We will add a note noting that that was a meeting at a non-regularly scheduled time. Is there a second to doing so?
Second.
There's a second. Are there any concerns about that? Is there any dissent to placing such a note? Hearing no dissent, such a note will be placed by unanimous consent. Are there any other comments, questions, or concerns regarding the minutes of November 7th, 2017? Hearing none, the speaker's list is exhausted. The chair puts the question. I'll move to. Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Any dissent? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of November 7th, please raise your hand or placard. Thank you. All who are opposed and all who'd like to abstain, the chair abstains. Jim Stone, I presume you're abstaining.
I'm abstaining.
Thank you. Just the minutes. By vote of 6-0-2, those minutes are approved. And I also apologize, I miscounted on the first set of minutes there, 6-0-1. That was a typo on my part.
Oh, it was 6-0-1?
Yes, it was my mistake. I miscounted. Thank you.
What was that vote?
That was 6-0-2. So that moves us into the. Also, there will be food arriving shortly, I've been assured. So when that happens, I'm sure we'll take a break to grab some pizza or whatever the food has been ordered. With that being said, moving on with our agenda, the next item of business is the annual report by the Digital Administrator. We're very happy to have Michelle Horvath, who's an official member of the committee, to give us a talk. We also have Christina Liang from the Office of the JA, who's here as well. So we thank you very much for your attendance, and you have the floor for the next 45 minutes or so.
Okay. My goal is to kind of give a brief summary and then really open the floor to questions and some thoughts. And so the report is long, but it's really only 14 pages of substance, and that's all the public records. And so it is our goal, once we finish our website revision, to put all the public records online so that they're easily more searchable and people will have several views from our office. So I think it's really important to note that this past year was really one of change. We had a lot of personnel changes. We had a lot of structure changes. And there was just kind of a lot going on in that regard. And so, but I think what I really want to highlight is the fact that we were trying to move a lot more towards a developmental approach. So really specifically and codifying how we're using student development theory, how we're using interpersonal development theories, and things of that nature. Two of the big highlights are our partnership with the Shaman Institute. And so we have a mediation program with them in which we use to reach SDAs, because the code doesn't say how an SDA has to be reached, it just says that it has to be reached. So we've been using a student program in which individuals actually take mediation classes and are enrolled in courses. They serve as mediators to reach an SDA. And we have a facilitated dialogue sanction, which has been really popular. So for example, if a student were to steal something from the bookstore, we have the risk management officer meet with the student, facilitated with the mediator. The OJ is not part of that because it's a sanction. And it's a really opportunity for restorative practices. So the students say, you know, this isn't what I typically would do. Here's why I did it. The risk management officer is going to talk about how this impacts price and the community and things of that nature. And it really starts to bound those relations. So we've been really happy with that. Another thing that we used and implemented last year was our probation program. And so the sanction of probation is something that is a little bit more of a serious sanction, but there wasn't a lot of development as to what that program looked like. Previously, it was an individual would check in with the JA's office once a semester while they were on probation, and that would be it. We thought there needed to be something a little bit more robust. And so using student development theory, Baxter McGold does, we said, you know, this is going to be something we're going to meet with a student four times. One of the things that we have them do is actually read the code of conduct, because it's important to know the expectations. Nobody really wants to read the 40-page document when they're excited about learning about their roommates and all the fun things when they come to Cornell. They meet with career services, so they can start to explain to future employers what a probation looks like on their record, why they have it, that they've learned, moved from it, are in good stand with the university. There's also a mentorship component, which is really fascinating. So we've reached a lot of different mentors in the community, so CUPD officers, the university treasurer is one of our mentors, and a wide range of individuals who really are twofolded. The first is for them to have another connection to Cornell, given that it's such a complex and diverse organization. If we can have a student have one more connection, one more place to be grounded, we think that we're in a much better place for that student's prevention of recidivism and moving forward as a productive member of our society. And those individuals also talk about things like values, looking at the mistakes that they've made, how to formulate your values as an adult in the community, and really work from that. There's also some assignments throughout. Individuals have to try something new on campus, so we have programs if they want to go to, like, Let's Mediate, if they want to go to a campus event. There's stories that they read from Cornell authors or from YouTube videos that really are the idea that we're trying to push them into a new view of the world and their experience of it to really develop the self-authorship that the theory kind of talks about. Another big procedural element that we had is that we had an online reporting system that was created jointly between our office and CUPD. And so that has really been able to decrease the length of time between an incident being reported to our office, a case being opened, and the adjudication to finality. And so that has been a really positive step for us. And that's a system that's available to anyone. And so we sometimes get landlords filling out the form, and it's been a really strong tool for us. We focused a lot, too, about detailing how we discuss our work and really saying, you know, these are the evaluation criteria that we look at. Here are the factors of harm that we consider. So then when we talk about what we do and we look at the consistency of our process, we're able to articulate, you know, this was a higher harm category on the physical risk, but it was a lower category on the emotional risk, and that's why the sanctions may look a little bit different. A lot of internal standardization, so just, you know, not only is it a campus conduct office, but we also do things like personnel management, budget management, and making sure that we were just kind of structured with that. Did a lot of shifting of how we notify respondents. So we wanted to make sure that individuals were notified in advance of coming to their office, and with the exception of one or two cases where we offered to reschedule or gave the person time to leave the room. And those usually go out about 24 hours in advance at minimum. So the individual knows the date, the time, the violations, and it's not as jarring. They also have a list of all the resources available to them, including the JCCs. We removed admission statements from our summary decision agreements. Previously, individuals would have to say, I admit that I did X, Y, and Z. Now it's by clear and convincing evidence, there could be a fine responsible for this and that decision. So that's been really important, especially for our cases where individuals have criminal cases pending as well. We also tried to increase readability and clarity of our documents. I think that's an issue that we've all talked about, is that the code language is not as readable as we would hope. And so in issues where we can make it more clear or ways we can summarize it, we've done that. So it seems a little bit less arduous for individuals coming in. We also amended our processes related to late or incomplete sanctions, making sure that those aren't lingering to the end of the semester and those are handled contemporaneous as possible. We also brought back the cases from RNSP adjudication. There was previous delegation to first-time alcohol and drug offenses, and I was more concerned about us having the Office of the Central Repository making sure that our consistent sanction was occurring. So those came back to our office, which has been a nice opportunity to make sure that things are looking consistent, and RNSP officers have the right to build their community and do more of that building versus necessarily the adjudicative aspect of it. We made the commitment to do no contact directives as reciprocal. We didn't actually have to issue any last year, but that was something that was going to be a commitment. And we did some internal recusal standards to make sure that we were really looking at the recusal standards that were appropriate for our office. Want to talk a little bit about just quickly the data. When you look at the, and I'm on page 9 of the annual report, if people have it, our cases fell from 673 to 536, but that is pretty much reflective of the fact that 6.4, policy 6.4 complaints were moved out of the office on August 1st. So that dip is proportional to the fact that that caseload really moved over to their office. Noted the dates from reported date of the incident to adjudication fell to 33 days. If we take out the hearings, which tend to bulk up, that's 23 days, and that's calendar days. So if you count, you know, we're looking at 2 weeks from the time the behavior occurred to when it's adjudicated and the student has an outcome, which is something we're really proud of. Findings of responsibility and not responsibility. We had 429 cases of responsibility, 144 of not responsible. The reason that those numbers don't add up to 754, which is the cases we had, is because of a Good Samaritan protocol. Individuals can't be held responsible for that. I do have concerns about the number of those cases, not because people aren't using and calling for help, but the fact that we have such a consistent disproportionate drinking pattern on our campus. And that's something that the Scorton Center and CUPD and other policy individuals have talked about, and really how do we find that balance of making sure people get help, but that they're not drinking to the point that they need help consistently. Consistent with most college campuses, unless they're single-gendered, our male respondents do make up a more proportionate amount of our cases referred to our office. And not surprisingly, freshmen tend to be our highest population. Athletics, consistently for the past 2 years, men football has been the highest athletic team referred, proportionally by their size. That makes sense. Although we don't adjudicate Greek chapters, we do adjudicate Greek individuals, and so those are pulled for your reference. The last kind of thing I want to mention is when you look at the sanctions from 2015 to 2016, the written reprimand has been the sanction that has shifted from an oral warning to a written reprimand. And that's been a policy decision of mine. That I think that if an individual does commit an action, there does need to be a record of that. We do explain that that is only reportable to graduation. And then once an individual has completed their sanctions, they're back in good standing with the university. And so future employers, schools are looking for, did you complete the sanctions? Did you not repeat the behavior? Are you back in good standing? And so we are happy to have office conversations with grad schools. I spoke with a woman last week who last month, who has completed her application for the bar, and we talked about her going in front of the Character and Fitness Board and how she would explain some of those behaviors. So I'm going to yield to questions or thoughts, feedback, and turn it over to y'all.
Thank you very much. So if you'd like to be on the speaker's list, please raise your hand or placard. I have Richard, and it's a question that we ask everyone is there anything that you think, and Nate as well, is the question we ask everyone is just, and Victoria, okay, thank you. No problem. You. The question we ask everyone is there anything that this committee or that we could bring back to the, I know you'll be presenting to the full UA, but anything that this committee or the assembly could do to help you or assist you in terms of advocacy, resources for the administration or anything else? Mm-hmm. Obviously, you'll be presenting the full assembly, and they will be the ones who will be doing a lot of the advocating. But that being said, for the more technical matters, this committee is very well adept in the code, and we'd be happy to offer our support if you have anything in particular you think we could assist you with.
Yeah, I think I'll wait for some feedback, but I think a lot of the concerns that I have about the process will be addressed with some code revisions, mm-hmm. but I'll be curious for kind of people's more thoughts before I kind of comment on those. But thank you.
Thank you. First and speakers then is Richard.
So Michelle, I have two questions. One is on that in your description, it sounded like most of the process changes over the last year have been in the direction of removing from records, official records, incidents. Is that right?
Opposite, that we want to create a more formalized record so that, if, for example, one of the inconsistencies that we were trying to solve is that, let's say, a student was arrested for marijuana. Mm-hmm. If they did a background check in our office, we would not report anything, but then when they got the report from the CUPD, there would be a reportable incident because there was an arrest. So we wanted to make sure that we were being consistent of that it was a referral to our office and there was an arrest so that it doesn't look like there's a discrepancy.
The other question is, in second offenses, you talk to them in the first and you tell them what's wrong and get them to agree and so forth. But in the second offense, is the process different?
No, so we look at the cases very independently. If it looks at responsibility and then differently when it comes to sanctions. So if somebody has two alcohol offenses, we say, okay, the first offense, they have to go to basics, which is a two-session learning behavior motivational class that's done through Connect Help. The second is a higher level where it's a AOD2 group where there's a more extensive intervention. But let's say that somebody, their first offense was related to drugs, and their second, they punched a professor. I don't mean to use the example. They punched a scarecrow. That would be an escalated sanction. So we would look at that and say, you know, that probably looks like something that might be considered probation because of that. If we had someone who had 5 alcohol violations in 1 semester, we would look to say, you know, it's really starting to see that you might need a little bit more incentive to follow the rules. And so it's not like something gets like super secret double probation on the second offense. Mm-hmm. We look to see what is their previous sanctions, and then we look to follow an escalation.
So if the offenses differ, the response isn't more severe, but if it's the same offense, then you escalate it.
Yeah, if an individual's on probation, a second offense might escalate it a little bit more quickly because they've already had incentive to be more compliant, and then we would look at, you know, what would be proportionate for the offense that they were found responsible for subsequent to probation.
Thank you. Next on the speaker list is Nate.
I apologize in advance because this is like what I'm interested in, so yeah, I have some questions. So just a small thing first. Can you clarify, I didn't understand entirely what you were saying about the admission statements of admission, and that you're doing away with written statements of admission? So can you say again why that is? I just didn't understand the person.
Yeah, so, and Kendall, you can chime in too, because you're here. So before, let's say that a student was found smoking weed in their dorm for it. The SDA, so the summary decision agreement, would have to say, you know, Michelle Horvath acknowledges that I was smoking marijuana on this date. And so they were actually creating a record saying that they admitted to the behavior. Instead of saying there's enough evidence behind
in future proceedings there. Mm-hmm. So essentially what removing those admission statements is meant to do is to insulate people from having a decision made by an office that like is rigorous but is not a formal legal proceeding falling into a legal proceeding.
That is the big one. It's also the fact that, you know, somebody is denying something. Let's say there's video recording, there's 12 witnesses, and they're still saying, like, no, I still didn't do it. Then that case would have just stalled because that admission statement couldn't have been reached.
Okay.
And so it's also reflective of just reasonableness.
The JCC office supports that policy change.
So the way there's like a chain of command thing that I want to clarify, because I know how it works in like the criminal justice world, but not how it works with your office. So, to go with the drug and alcohol violation thing, there is a national movement to lower the drinking age to 18, right? For a bunch of reasons, many of which are pretty good, some of which are probably not. And it would probably have outcomes, some of which are good, some of which are not good. And obviously there's a difference between somebody who's under the age of 21 who is drinking or who's giving alcohol to somebody else and somebody who is using alcohol or another drug to inflict harm in like a hazing or a sexual assault, like a date rape context. Are you, like, what are the bounds of your prosecutorial discretion on that?
Sure. So, yes, do I have amnesty that I can grant, or
can you choose not to pursue certain categories substance offense? Can you choose to not pursue them as vigorously? You know, where? And this is maybe because I'm new to the CJC. Like, can this committee ask you to exercise your discretion in certain ways, or can only the president do that, or VP Lombardi? Like, where does your prosecutorial discretion come from?
Sure. So I'm a completely independent office, and so I actually report to no one, which is an interesting place to be.
You're a special prosecutor.
I am, but I also report to the University of Sundays. I'm appointed by them, recommended by the president and the board of trustees. Serves ultimately as the discretion. So it's kind of a weird people, when people talk about my boss, I refer them to Gabe, to the president, to the board of trustees. An example that I think might highlight that is, so let's say we have a, for example, if there's underage drinking and a policy 6.4 case, I yield jurisdiction on that because we want to get to the underlying issue. If it's something involved with hazing and let's say alcohol consumption at the time, we would charge both. Because we think it's important to actually capture the behavior that occurred. Do I have discretion not to bring cases? Yes, but if there's a complaint that they can show cause to a university hearing board and say, Jay, you exercised your discretion wrongly. And then it would go to the university hearing board, which is a check on the system. I don't know if that quite answered what you were looking for, and I'm happy to answer if it's not.
I think it does. Yeah, that does.
I know, actually, and I gave you what said you may want something to add to that that might provide context.
So I had other questions,
okay.
And I can bring that. I think I might have been able to help address that.
Well, that's why, because you're down the speaker list, but if you want something that might address the question, it might be.
Okay, yeah, so in the code where it first mentions the judicial administrator, it says, the office of the judicial administrator receives, investigates, and pursues accusations of violations of the campus code of conduct, or of any other regulation as the university assembly or board of trustees may direct. Anyone can direct such accusations or any questions about the judicial system to that office.
All right.
So I think the UA can do that.
And then I just have one other question for you. What is in the position of your office? Do you have an opinion on the fact that that there is no analog for you on the side of respondents who is not a student and who thus isn't subjected to periodic turnover as the JCCs are? And I know that you guys have good institutional memory, and I think your institution runs really well, but you're still at some sort of institutional disadvantages compared to the office of the JA.
So when I looked through some of the historical documents, there was actually the thought to create an office of the judicial codes counselors as a university office, so there's supposed to be a parallel. We are roughly, there's not many campuses that actually have a JCC office, so on one hand, we're actually very advanced in where we're going at. I think what's interesting is that I probably turn over more rapidly than the JCCs do in theory, because my position is a two-year appointed position. And so In the same way that there could be a concern about institutional memory on the JCC side, there could be a side on the JA side. So do I think that if this was a courtroom setting, it would be very disproportionate? Yes, but we're an administrative educational setting. And so I recognize the disparity, and that's one of the things that I can't figure out. And if there's a smarter brain than me to figure out how do we have a student hearing represented by themselves or by a student, and then have a professional who, for example, is an attorney and has advanced training. If you can figure out the student conduct world would change drastically, and that might be a good thing, but it's not a question that I haven't thought about. I just haven't come up with the answer.
And Nate, the CJC in past years has looked at with the compliance advisor under 6.4. There's a number of things about in terms of having them confirmed by the UA, but there's also talk of for certain areas where the university is not a complainant, for instance, say simple assault, where in essence there would be an option to back them into the code where they could serve as a procedural advisor. That is still, it hasn't gone much further than just, I guess, very much basic discussions, but that is something that has been explored and considered in the past for precisely the reasons you mentioned.
And there's people have the right to an advisor and support person of their choice, and they're often attorneys. That's a check.
Next is Victoria.
All right, so I have also two questions. My first question is just, how are you apprising people who are your decision makers or the review boards of the changes that you've made to sanctions like probation?
Sure. So from a case manager perspective, inter-officely, we meet twice a week for case briefs, and we've spent retreats and summers making sure that we're all on the same side philosophically, and we talk about every single case as an office. When it comes to hearing boards, the JCCs in our office pairs with the university hearing boards, the chairs of required training, and so we present all this to them, just letting them know what the code requires. It's up to their own discretion. And that's kind of how we make sure that there's institutional consistency.
So would the new change, the kind of new change to the probation and other systems go into like the training for this next year for the upcoming new members?
That happened last summer for the training, so it was already in place. Yeah, so, and when I took over the office, the JCCs as a staff in our office meets twice a year. And we talked about all the changes. We took some of the feedback that they had and made some changes. So.
Great. And then just one more question. I wondered why you settled on 24 hours of notice instead of a larger window.
24 hours in what regard?
Oh, sorry.
The notice letters before meeting with an AJA.
We try to do it as much as we can.
Oh, okay.
But just a lot of the time students will say, like, I want to come in right now.
Oh.
And we're like, well, okay, this is what you want. Here's your notice letter. It takes some time. So we try to be as we don't cater to the students' wishes, but we acknowledge that it could be kind of concerning to have this JA hanging over you. So if we have time in our office and somebody's available, we do that. But we try to do that 24 hours. So it's at least a minimum.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the speakers is Jeremy.
So I've just got a couple of quick things. First off, I really want to thank you and our incoming president for really putting a focus on the restorative justice move for our code, for our culture. I think that's, for me, that's huge. I've been an advocate for that for a while. In reference to your presentation, you talked about risk categories and considerations and how to put kind of a real metric, a set of guidelines that creates a standardization of making decisions. And I assume that the JCC is also has got that kind of standard for making decisions, you have also a set of kind of standards and guidelines on how you go about offering support and to your folks that grant.
Standards and guidelines are very vague.
What I'm looking at is what I'm looking at is the Hearing and Review Board, who actually decides on these things, in the past has referenced the code of conduct, but we haven't had a set of direction guidelines, something definitive to create a standard way of approaching that. And what I'm looking for is, are there resources in either one or both of your offices to create a means of looking at, because as we're talking about approaching a plain language code of conduct, are there resources already created that we can kind of leverage to help create a set of guidelines for understanding and approaching the code of conduct?
So when it comes to matrices, our office, and it's shared publicly, we share with every presentation, we look at likelihood of harm to self, to others, and to the community. And then we look at reputational, facilities, physical, emotional, and reputational risk. And so when we present this to a hearing board, we say, you know, spray painting on a building is a high facilities risk, and because high facilities risk to the university, and because there is a racial epithet, the high emotional risk towards others. And so that's what we talk about when we talk about sanctioning. When it comes to organizing and structuring, there's campus codes of conduct out there that actually organize by institutional values that are really interesting to talk about. Well, you know, this actually really impacted the sense of community for this campus, and this is the sanction philosophy in that regard. And so is that
what that makes sense, and I think part of the reason why my question might have been a bit confusing is because I was missing a piece that you just gave me. When you present these cases, you really provide that structure to that hearing board, so they have that framework to work within. Is that am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, we put it in all the trainings and whenever we speak.
Great, that's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you. And the other, you mentioned the drinking rate and that it's incredibly high here, if I understood correctly. Is that higher than it in other universities are tonight? Do you know? And is that been a steady rate, or has the rate been increasing?
I can tell you from our office it's been increasing.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's comparative to peer institutions.
Okay.
Chief's owner might have some information. The Swarton Center probably has an information.
Yeah, they have the best information right now, the current information. So I talked to Tim Marshall or Laura Santa Cruz.
But, I mean, we open a case on Monday, and 8 of our cases involve transport out of 10.
Yeah.
Which is really concerning.
Yeah. Actually, on that, there was a presentation a couple of years ago saying that Ithaca or Cornell has a higher than average amount of drinking compared to city campuses. There was an inference that I'm not sure. I believe it was off the cuff, not actually backed up by data, but it's because there's a dearth of non-drinking nightlife. And there was also some information that was circulated that rural campuses tend to have higher than suburban or city campuses. Again, the suggestion put forward, but was very much caveated with that it's not data, but the inference people were drawing was it might be the lack of nightlife or lack of non-alcohol nightlife, which I believe there's been some movement on programming to try and address that. But in terms of the alcohol, I can certainly see if we can find that old presentation and send it along to you.
Oh, cool.
Next in sports is Gabe.
Hi. Thanks so much for being here and for generating, I think, you know, an excellent report. I actually just have two questions. So my they're basically the same question. But so I noticed that the organizational respondents increased from 0 to 6. And the way I see it, that's like a different increase than like if it were just like 1 to 6, because it shows that like different people are viable, or like different organizations are essentially being prosecuted. So my question is, what sorts of organizations fall under those respondents? What sorts of violations are they usually charged with? And then how does what is the sanctioning process? Like who is, like how are the sanctions done? So that's my question.
Sure. So the type of organization, anything that falls under our code is anything besides Greek organizations.
Right.
So the cases included, Cayuga's Waiters, Hindu Council, Water Margin, Prospect of Whitby, Stewart House, and a business fraternity that we were unable to identify the respondent, but we had opened up a case. And so some of them ranged from, there was Water Margin, and I can share this because they're not forever protected. So they had a bonfire, and it was too close to the house, so it was a fire safety violation. So their sanction was to do the fire safety class as an organization, as a house. And so usually we say we look at about 85% to 95% attendance on those, and we work with the president and the advisor as the representative for the organization. You know, we had a pretty severe hazing case. One of the respondents that was referred to our office as an organization, they were accused of fraud because what happened is during their leadership transition, they forgot to change the bank statements of his leadership. And so that was a very small sanction of talking about develop a leadership plan so this doesn't happen again. And so I think one of the things that we're really working towards, even with hazing cases, is that A lot of the times the first referral won't be a dismissal. And I know that's a big change. It's not to say that there aren't times when the first referral won't be a dismissal, in the same way if a student was referred for a very serious violation. And so our goal is to make sure that the organizations fall in with compliance and being successful in that regard. Is that what you were?
Yep. That's, thank you.
Thank you. Next is David.
I'm curious with for the annual report. Is it mandated to have a quantitative analysis of the FTE costs of your office, which is owner's office, and the resources, i.e. money, associated with the administration of this process of restorative justice? Right? It would be interesting to see the trends over time. Right? And also if the students see the amount of money that's required to administer this process, they actually might stop themselves a little bit by saying, I don't want my tuition to go up. Right? And so someone's going to, it's more of a peer-to-peer approach to controlling the behavior. But I don't know if that's in that report. Is that required for this report?
There isn't, and there's actually no outline of what's required in my report. Yeah.
Is it too much of a burden on your office or anyone else's office to ask for that quantitation of the impact of this process?
I think the challenge is that most of my staff is exempt, so we don't track our hours like a law firm,
yeah.
So we've never get accurate information.
Okay.
I know my team does really large amounts of work on the weekends, stay late,
yeah.
And stuff like that, and so I don't want us to get into the hours.
Sure,
no,
it's not just you. I mean,
but,
it impacts everybody. Right?
But
it's
I think
a big deal.
Yeah, if somebody wants
yeah.
to make a public campaign to really figure out what the cost of the case, I'd be interested in seeing that.
I went to a professional school, right? Any of these things came up, you were kicked out. And so our burden was very, very low because no one did it, right? But this is a very different place, so just curious. Excellent.
Well, and just one thing on that, the law school actually has a carve out for their honor code, which is in some areas is slightly different than the code, and it's referenced. An academic integrity law school is a carve out, and a couple of other places, some of the professional schools have carve outs.
Yeah.
And actually, this would be, you may remember at the beginning of the year, I brought forward the Johnson Honor Code uses a lower quantum of proof and doesn't have a carve out, which is something that we're actually, reminds me, I haven't heard back from them, so I will have to follow up with them. But we do have, and the university does in some places have carve outs as it is. It's just a matter of how they're administered and where they fit.
But you're right, with the higher burden of proof. Our students, even in all of our professional schools, can be a little less of citizens sometimes than we would hope of some of our standards. So that's reflective of that clarity.
Yeah. But the students saw us, $150 annually, because my fraternity brother can't refrain from drinking underage. So that's a fair amount of money.
Yeah, I think that would be an interesting view, even just with the cases. Salary.
Thank you. Next on the speakers is Richard. Oh, Terrell, do we have plates or are you getting them? Okay. Well, once we get plates, I think we'll take a 2-minute recess to grab some food. But next is Richard.
So, first, a relevant observation on Matt's comment. If the cultural scuttlebutt is that professors of rural institutions have a much higher rate of homelessness, which I think it's probably right. But anyway, it's just an observation. The second thing is a question based, actually, on Nate's question about discretion. You have, your office and Kathy's office actually have relations with the local police. And the discretion that I would be interested in this question about is the discretion to refer violations of state law or city law to the police or not, which is actually something maybe more sensitive than even the internal code discretion. So you may not want to talk about that much, but that's the question is, how do you handle that?
So the only time that I'm mandated to refer something to a state agency is if there's a minor involved or there's a sexual assault or something that falls under policy 6.4. So I don't refer, if I learned their student that they were smoking weed and they were also smoking alcohol, I don't call, the prosecutor or the police and say this happened. And so I don't.
So that's a practice rather than discretion.
I don't think you have the authority.
I've never been at any campus where any conduct professional
yeah.
refers
okay.
unless it's.
Yeah, it would just be our office.
Would it be appropriate to ask you?
The discretion is by and large by position and by level of disruption, violation, or violence. So it can be applied in any one of a number of different ways. There are the vast majority of our arrests, they are still counted by the state as arrests, even if they're a referral to the Office of the Judicial Administrator. For student and some minor levels of staff and faculty, go to the Office of the Judicial Administrator. Sometimes we can exercise discretion on lower level violations, whether or not they also get a city appearance ticket. That's generally around a repeat offense, or there's an elevated charge with alongside a something lower level violation. And other times, the victim who is then disrupted has an opportunity to charge either criminally. So we just facilitate that. So we wouldn't exercise discretion in that. We would forward it through to the district attorney. Ultimately, the district attorney holds ultimate discretion. So we charge. But the district attorney can deny those charges or send them to grand jury or adjudicate. So
it's a matter of state records that can't be expunged.
Actually, that's not true. The state can seal a record. They can expunge depending on the level of crime. We can't.
That's right.
Generally speaking, our court systems are not at all inclined to go, especially for a lower level defense. Offense, it's more of a violation. Most of those are especially for a first-time violator, nonviolent violator. Those are sealed cases. They are expunged. They're adjournment and contemplation of dismissal. So there's nothing really that carries over on those. It's really the more serious offenses that you're talking about having a carryover charge.
Thank you. We have pizza and we have plates. So if there's no objections, I wouldn't mind taking a minute just to grab some food. I know people are staring at it, so I'm please
smell it now, right?
Yes.
The enticement is there.
We're
going to
take a quick break to grab some. Please help yourself, everyone.
Oh my gosh, it's ridiculous.
I was wondering if drinking incidences increased in
No, they've been very steady, but they've been very high.
Squares?
The alcohol.
Because it makes it easier, because in terms of people are getting dangerous. Spend more pizza with more people.
I guess, yeah, just make sure you email them.
Some of it has to do with, I mean, so it's right things outside of our control, like national food, I know places that don't.
So there's a 2-day hotel under mental health diagnosis. The people who choose to operate outside of that self-care and then affects other people, that's problematic. But then there's also the addiction issues are
the questions that I have that are not like questions, they're just like
very well meaning, very good citizens.
And I need some regulars, so I'm not going to take up their time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so funny
because need money to get high.
Last year we didn't have
and all those things that we described as
funds. It is so great. Like, too, but it's just like, oh, I feel like it's a perfect person to have in front of the office.
True.
We like a lot of times. I go walk around with students outside and like do the probation check and stuff like that. And Janie did one today, and then my office looks on the side door. Like the students like pulled in the door, and I was like, "I'm trying to do like."
Well,
so that's right.
Oh yeah. I also like, you know, I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about students.
Well, today I would really say
that. Exactly. No, it's just want to pass that on. Definitely. People come out of meetings and they're like, oh, I've been today.
What's that man?
And they okay. get their, like, he is the opposite of what they expected.
Yeah. You know, so now it's more like,
yeah, let's try
talking. And I think that most people.
Yeah, we, one of the things that they do is
Hello, everyone. I think we're going to get back going. Please feel free to grab some food and sit down. I hope everyone enjoyed the pizza. Please feel free to get up and grab something you'd like at any time. Next on the speakers list is Sarah Park.
My question is actually answered. So
fantastic. Well, in that case, I actually, knowing that the speakers was exhausted, I actually had a quick question that was raised in terms of the public record, in terms of how public is public, and in that there are, I've seen, and there are places, for instance, that will harvest mugshots from the internet and then try and use them in a malicious way, doesn't pay us. It's almost an extortion racket. Those are being clamped down on. And fortunately, our hearing board records are much, much less involved and detailed, but especially noting that in recent time, the hearing board chairs have, and I would argue it's a good thing, they've started filing much more detailed reports in terms of, is it even so much as having just up there as a PDF, it could be web scraped, or is it something, I think a NetID login is a questionable, because then you run the risk of locking out people who might have legitimate interest, but almost some way to try and make it so that it's not, so if you go find it, you can find it, but that it's not, someone can't just run an automated script and just pull it and go, oops, now I have this and I'm going to try and find some way to use it. So just, I'm not sure, I know you said you're exploring about something just to be aware of.
So the names aren't in the public record unless mm-hmm. it's a public hearing. So is
but
that...
Actually, the hearing board members are, no, the hearing board chair, actually, never mind, actually. I, for some reason, I was thinking the hearing board members are, but they're not. So never mind. It was just in terms of noting that some records are public. It just isn't something to be concerned over, that data is going out. In essence, once the genie is out of the bottle, you can't put it back in.
Yeah, I think on that point, Cornell is the only campus that I've worked at or heard that actually has a public record system.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very transparent thing that I think is good in regards to what we say is accountability. And so I think my goal is that if it's in there and the code that's required, I'm going to make it as transparent as possible. But if you see through the public records, there's only two public records that aren't redacted.
Mm-hmm.
The first is organizations, because they don't have FERPA protection. And the second being the public record, hearing. And that is because it was requested to be public.
Yes, of course. And I think the transparency is essential. An electronic record would make, in terms of, even I've encouraged a number of people to look at the Hayes Waivers record, because it's exactly the reason we need strong hazing prevention after reading. I must say it's not pleasant reading, but in terms of just thinking that if there is, being public is excellent in the community, and frankly, people who are associated with the community need access, but obviously to try and as much as possible foresee, could something go awry in terms of switching from paper to electronic, because that's certainly something that has happened in other spheres. But I commend the public, or the making things even more public. I think the electronic will make it easier for people to review, especially when I say, oh, I just went to the office and looked through all the binders. That's a step that a lot of people aren't going to take. And mm-hmm. like I said, the speakers is exhausted. Is there anything else you think that the committee should be aware of? Anything you think we could work on or look at? And then after that, we'll move on with our agenda.
I think the only thing that I'd want to put on the UA's radar and the CJC is that hazing is an institutional nightmare. I've never seen it so pervasive from organizations, Greek, academic departments. And there's a lot of really devoted and dedicated people working to reduce this. But this really has to come from a student and a community effort and standards. And so it's going to be something that our office continues to work with campus partners. But, you know, we get an investigation, and one of the things that's really hard from a hazing point of view is the code requires us to give notice that witnesses have to be provided to JCC, which is fine. But there's public record that says if someone's a member of an organization, they can't be questioned. And so that is really hard because let's say that we have an individual who was a second semester member of the organization who probably experienced hazing as well. We can't call that individual once we've charged the organization. And that was the public record that was coming from the waiters. And so that's a really challenging place for our office to do investigations and to really look to stop a systemic problem. It's just the way that it's drafted. So I would really ask this committee to consider whether or not there needs to be an organizational exception to say that we're trying to underline the issue of hazing. And if we're having to give members and not be able to speak with members once their organization is charged, it's really challenging. So we can speak to the new members, but we can't speak to the members.
Thank you. Jeremy, just a minute on that.
Just real quick, do you have any insight into why that was created initially?
I don't have insight. And I don't have insight as to why the hearing board reviewed it and interpreted it in that way, but now that it's public record, our office has an obligation to follow that precedent.
So in essence, just for everyone, drawing very, very rough parallels, the CJC UA and the presidential approval, in essence, you could analogize to a legislature. The hearing boards are the judiciary, so in essence, they interpret, however they come out within public record and interpret the code, those precedents are going to be used moving forward unless the hearing board changes its mind, which actually the review board would have to review it, or the code is itself addressed to amend that. So that would, in essence, just as you signed in the real world, again, doing very loose, the ball would move back to us to say, okay, we see this interpretation. This is something that we're not necessarily on board with. How do we tweak this, okay, or in essence respond?
And what I was hoping for is if there was some history as to the intent of that wording, if there was intent there, but it sounds like nobody's quite sure why it exists that way.
We have minutes going back. Oh gosh, I mean, I have minutes going back to the 60s, so we could certainly do. I mean, I could certainly do some digging, but that would be. I'd be happy to work with you offline just to see. I did notice that in terms of trying to discern how we can do that, because if that's
illogical.
Exactly. If that needs a band-aid fix, as much as we'd like to look holistically, if it's something that we need to fix quickly, hazing is an issue. We can look at that. Yes.
Michelle mentioned, and this is kind of a side note, that witnesses are offered the JCC email, but as a policy in our office, we don't represent witnesses or advise them. So they have to go into the JA office without an advisor because there's only four people in our office, and it often conflicts us out from actually helping respondents if there's a situation where there's more than four respondents. Even though the code says that the JA has to refer witnesses to, or can, has to give witnesses our name, in the code it says we only represent students who are accused of violating the code of conduct. So I made a policy decision that we don't represent witnesses.
Thank you. Noting that we are running low on time with this presentation, Michelle, I have two more people on the speakers list, Nate and then Sarah. So,
just a quick question for either of you guys. Is there like a Fifth Amendment analog where witnesses can't be charged under the code as the result of things they say in the course of providing testimony to UHRD?
It's not our practice to do so because we support the fact that people need to be notified. That. And so if we think that a student has information that is important to our case, but we reveal a code violation that they do, we limit the amnesty. So we would say drug and alcohol use, but if we learn them during discovery, you know, if they disclose to a hearing board without us knowing that they were going to talk about drug distribution, that might be a different issue. But we take a really hard stance on making sure that people's procedural rights are respected.
There is also, there was a question that was brought up a number of years ago in terms of if you were speaking to CUPD in terms of, because there are certain areas where if you were to exercise your Fifth Amendment rights to decline to speak to a law enforcement officer, could that go through the code? That was a discussion that happened a number of years ago. I'd be happy to talk to you offline about that. That's a very detailed area, but it does touch upon that. Next is Sarah.
I just want to know, is this policy the same for grief organizations?
No, so our jurisdiction is not...
Oh, I mean in their office. Like, do they have the same policy?
No, they have a different standards of the practice and procedures. So they have a grief review board and grief judicial board. And so I don't have the bandwidth in my head to know their full policies and procedures, but they're publicly available and you can speak to their office.
Thank you. The speakers is exhausted. We also happen to have just run around 45 minutes. So thank you very much, Michelle. If anyone has other questions, please feel free to email me and I'll pass them along or just email Michelle directly and we can then have those resolved. Next on the agenda is the UHRB questions. I know that we would like to get to the hate speech working group update. This is a very, I'll give you a 30-second update, and if we have discussion, you can move it to later. The questions you have here are the questions we did last year, newly revised. As I described in prior meetings, our goal is to hopefully have these squared away by our next meeting, which is the week after Thanksgiving, to then work with the Office of the Office of Assemblies to start the actual recruitment process right as the semester begins, which is generally actually it's quite far ahead of schedule, which hopefully will allow us to not have to have extra meetings, or at the very least, also, if we get down to the last five or six candidates for a couple spots, we have historically done interviews. We generally, this past couple years, haven't had time to do interviews. That's something that we could elect to do. But anyways, to allow ourselves flexibility and to do a thorough vetting. There were two suggestions for questions. The easiest one is 13, which is just anything else you want us to know. We put a word cap on it because, obviously, if we say, what else do you want to know? We don't need your life story. Mm-hmm. But there's something that's missing. And then also for question 11, a question about, with ambiguity, doing something in terms of a hypothetical or a hypothetical and an ethereal question. I was toying with the idea of, okay, something almost a little bit, almost to the point where you never see, like, okay, say the code prevents wearing light colors in the winter or something, mm-hmm. something on those lines where the language is intentionally ambiguous to try and get it something more concrete, but also something that you would never, ever see. So that you're getting the thought process and not getting someone's thoughts about something that's actually you might come across. That being said, those are still ongoing. Is there any quick questions or comments on those? Nate.
When we have these hypos on these questions and maybe adding one to 11, are there articulated standards for what we expect to see in the answer, or is this just sort of we're trying to trawl this person's brain and see what we get, and then we decide on it as CJC?
It's the latter. Okay. It's looking at thought process. Victoria?
I was wondering if you, especially in question two, could add sort of more of a range of possible times. Like, does evening mean between, like, 5 and 7? Does it mean between 7 and 9? If the training generally happens in the first month of classes or something like that, I think it would be useful to include those sort of even very general references that help people kind of plan their own lives.
And thank you for reminding me. Actually, Michelle had mentioned that the JA has been trying to standardize hearings to, want to say, one week night and then Friday, and Christina may know that, but there are some dates they've been trying to, obviously there's always exceptions, but thank you for reminding me. I will actually confirm those dates I have in writing from her. And actually add that in, saying they so we can have a better idea of their availability.
Thank you.
Anything else? Fantastic. That leads us to our next item, which I believe will consume the remainder of our agenda, is the hate speech working group and discussion. So I will actually first provide an update. I spoke to Connor Hodges, who's the chair. He informed me that he has some relatively severe family emergency. I won't say more than that, out of his privacy, but that has precluded him from doing a lot, and he anticipates it'll be resolved relatively soon, but the past week he's been handling that. That being said, we still need to move forward, and I do have some information from him that about in terms of just some ideas here, spitballing, which I have at this point, the GPSA has appointed their individual. I know the faculty senate is in the process. Actually, I need to reply to Dean Van Loan about that, and then I know the other assemblies are also hard at work. So in terms of speaking with Connor in terms of just sharing that information, at the very least, just saying here's a time working with people, at the very least, can have a discussion amongst themselves with or without Connor if he can make it, to at the very least get the ball rolling. We actually were considering having a forum today, which didn't happen because of that family emergency, and just to try and at the very least get things running before the end of the semester, noting that in this case, we realistically have one full week of school left, and then after that, it's all exams. But that being said, there's a lot there. I know Gabe was first. If anyone else wanted to speak, please let me know and I'll write you down. I see Nate, and okay, we'll continue.
Yeah, so I mean, you were there, but like yesterday at the UA meeting, obviously the UA said that we want to have, like, we recognize that the timeline that we originally set is probably a little bit ambitious. But I just want the committee to know that we have, like the UA has essentially asked the CJC to develop a time, like a new timeline mm-hmm. for the working group to come back to the CJC with. And so I just want to like make sure that that's on everybody's radar, because I think that the CJC is expected to develop a timeline like pretty soon.
So
we'll report back to the UA with that timeline.
Thank you. And then actually, as I referenced at the UA yesterday, this is our only meeting between now and the next UA meeting, because next week being Thanksgiving, Wednesday, no one will be here, and I wouldn't expect that of anyone. Speaking with Connor, there was, and based off of the old timeline that the CJC had approved, in essence, that had been spread out quite a bit. I will circulate that to the CJC. Again, it's very much rough, and as I said, we had a brief conversation in terms of me saying, Connor, what are your thoughts? Just in terms of having him write things down so that he could go to the working group. And our goal is hopefully once our family matters are handled, he will be able to do this. But they really just send it out to the committee and the members of the working group. So at the very least, the working group can amongst themselves confer, determine what they'd like to do, and have something back to the UA. Also noting that over Thanksgiving, I suspect people will be with their families as they should be. But that is something that is certainly on our radar. And next on the speaker list is Nate.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure that we're on the same page from a formality and transparency and communication standpoint here, because as far as I am concerned, I have not received formal notice. I don't know about you, Professor Lewis. I have not received formal notice that I'm on this ad hoc yet. So there has been, I believe, no formal vote within CJC on anybody but Connor.
No, to clarify, there was a formal vote about yourself, Connor, and Professor Leibowitz. We're still actually looking for an employee, noting that the two employees in this committee are heavily committed. And actually, in terms of figuring out how we want to handle it, if either of you would like to serve, please feel free. But and I that's what exactly. So we will, in terms of finding someone else who would be willing to be appointed by us, we did vote on it a number of meetings ago. I can find the exact date. If you'd like a formal note, we can certainly send one. I know I have it written down and recorded. You were formally confirmed. And that actually was done via, that was the mail vote back in the couple of weeks ago.
Oh, that was included with our motion to approve Connor.
Yes, you were all three of them.
Okay. All right. So then I think just like it's important that we make sure that we, you know, continue to do things by formal motion and have like things we can point to in our minutes, et cetera. And I'm excited to see who we get from the employee assembly. But I also wanted to comment on a new timeline. The imperative thing to me, as I was thinking about this, is that working backwards, we give the UA the opportunity to show something to President Pollack and then have one more meeting at which it can take formal action on her response. So the thing that I would want to do from the CJC standpoint is be able to send something from the CJC to the UA with enough time for the UA to deliberate on it at one or possibly two meetings. And then she has a month to respond, I believe, once like she does to any assembly's motion. And that at the end of that month, there would still be one UA meeting left at which the UA could formally commend her for adopting whatever we sent her or formally chastise her for disregarding the will of the people. And so if we work backwards, that would mean one UA meeting after the 30 days after UA gets it for at least one meeting and maybe two, which means that CJC would then have to provide it in time for all of that to happen. I mean, the ad hoc would need to provide it in time for all of that to happen. And I think if the ad hoc brings the CJC something before spring break, that works, but I haven't actually like plotted it out. So I'm not actually giving like dates right now, but that's how I think we should be thinking. Ad hoc gives something to CJC in time for CJC to give something to UA in time. UA gives something to President Pollack in time for her to respond however she does, and then UA says something about it.
And to add another level of complexity to the presidential task force, they're operating in tandem, and I know President Pollack and her address to UA in another written statement, they're going to be working alongside the committee and the working group, which creates, in terms of coordination, if, in essence, they're working together, which I hope we will, there's also opportunity because the head of that working group is University Council's office mm-hmm. or University Council to have some back channel discussions about where things are going with language to hopefully avoid necessarily a flat out rejection or to have some massaging early.
Yeah, and hopefully back and forth with University Council and the President's office will happen. I also believe from having consulted the UA's charter that the UA has like kind of plenary power over the code other than what the President decides. And so You know, I think we shouldn't feel ourselves to be bound to whatever timeline the presidential task force comes up with, or bound to following where it leads on code revisions, which are explicitly the province of this committee and thus of the university community.
Thank you. That is correct as well, and something we're aware of. Next on speakers is Richard.
So we had a presentation at the Faculty Senate meeting last week. At recently presented the argument and procedure and thinking of this committee. But then the people who looked like they're going to be running the task force or participating heavily gave a presentation. And in their presentation, they used language that, in my hearing, came very close to preempting, if we didn't move, preempting our jurisdiction and authority. And in the discussion, the dean of the faculty, Charlie Van Moten, replied to one of my replies with language that impeached the speed at which we were proceeding to consider the hate speech problem and issues. And so afterwards, I talked to him about this because what this meant. He said the committee wasn't even formed yet because we weren't staffed. And afterwards, I talked to him about this, and he said, look, you know, if this doesn't move ahead, you know, the task force could carve out hate speech from the code and act alone. And then, so yesterday at the University Assembly meeting with President Pollack there, I raised that possibility, and she said, no, they wouldn't do that. But it still is more than a parallel proceeding. And if we do not act with more speed, efficiency, some kind of whatever, you know, we're in trouble. You know, the legitimacy of this process has already been called into question. So the timeline, I mean, Gabe is right, and the University Assembly asked for a timeline. We have to give them a timeline. There's no, but this timeline should take into account, you know, that we should move faster than we've been moving. And that, you know, there are a number of ways of thinking about this, but it's just, to my mind, it's a serious problem. It's not one in which we can meet every week and say, has the subcommittee met, and it hasn't, and say, that's okay. You know, at some point, we have to, my own feeling, I mean, I'll just throw it out there. My own feeling is we should dissolve the subcommittee and we should bring it back here. And we should do that immediately. And you know, if the members of the subcommittee can, you know, they can certainly listen to them and so forth and so on. But if they're not here, if they're not meeting and so forth, we got to do it ourselves. And we have to do that soon. But that's only my feel for it. I'm just saying the issue is much more urgent than just worrying about weeks.
Thank you. Next on speaker list is Chief Zahner.
I'm going back to more of a processy talking about if someone had an idea on to recommend an employee to the committee, what would that look like? Should we get it to the employee assembly directly, and then they would make the recommendation?
I've contacted the employee assembly. In fact, that's what I'm just doing, too, is reminding them that is on our evaluation.
So I have a recommendation for you. I'll just give it to you.
Perfect. And I will submit that recommendation to the exec committee.
So in terms of structure, each assembly has a seat that they can appoint, and they're sole prerogative. The CJC also has four seats, one from each constituency. Three of those have been filled by members of this committee. Looking at the incredible number of hats that you and Jeremy wear, just in terms of trying to, I mean, if either of you'd like to serve, that's certainly something that we'd be more than happy to have, but it's just in terms of making sure that we have someone who is able to do this and at all, not to put people on the spot. Next on the speakers list is Michelle.
Gabe and I just looked at some of the assembly's agendas and just to do kind of the math for Nate. And for if kind of the plan is that it's introduced to the UA, voted on, sent to the president, 30-day window, and then whether commending or condemning would have to be introduced, then voted on, which means that that would have to be to the University Assembly by 3/13.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks for the CJC, if the CJC meets weekly next semester in the same way, means that a final proposal would need to be to this committee by February 28th. That doesn't bring into Richard's point about if there's a need to move that timeline a little bit forward so that it doesn't run exactly parallel with the presidential committee. So just members of this committee who are on that, if Richard's motion doesn't move forward, to divest the committee and bring it back to the CJC.
Thank you. Time, unfortunately, we want to consult everyone because all of a sudden semesters have become quite short. Next speaker is Anna.
All right, I was going to make the point about counting backwards. We would need the UA by 3/13. By March 13th. And that is assuming that we introduce it one meeting and pass it the next. And with this, I am concerned about our ability to do that. I would like to express my frustration here that the ad hoc committee has not been able to meet because they have not known they've been formally charged. That something has happened on our end here, and that what I had felt was a clear push in September to prioritize this above other matters already on the agenda has fallen by the wayside. We have not just found ourselves at the end of the semester, but I will leave it at that.
Thank you. Noting the time, we actually expired the time. Is there a motion to extend for, say, 5 or 6 minutes? I know I have a comment.
Second.
Any dissent? Hearing none, the meeting is extended to 5:50. In terms of the formal charge, the committee was formally charged. So there is a charge in terms of people notified. We just had the GPSA notified on Monday, and therefore the three people who are appointed were all on this committee, and therefore, at the very least, they weren't aware of the charge, and that there was a communications breakdown that I would happily apologize for, but we are attempting to move forward, and we continue to do so. Next in the speakers list is Risa, and then Nate in the second speakers list.
Okay, great. So I've got a few points. I mean, one is, you know, I think that there's an appropriate sense of urgency to actually get going on this. But I think it's all doable. It's just that, you know, for us to have a legitimate process and a working group that is looking like it's on a timeline is important. But setting that aside for the moment, I would also point out that the presidential task force hasn't yet been put together. So it isn't like that's a task force that's up and running. It's still being nominated. And so, like, I got something saying that I've been nominated and I should now self-nominate if I want to do it. And I need to do that tonight. I'm not sure if it gives you a choice about the subgroups.
It does.
Okay, good. Because I thought I would nominate myself for the free speech, you know, the speech issue subgroup. Because I think actually having some, doesn't mean I'll get on it, but having some kind of interaction that's very, very direct would be a good thing for that, so that it doesn't become these two parallel lines. Also, in terms of the relationship with the presidential task force, when I gave the presentation at the Senate meeting, I emphasized more than once that the CJC and the UA have jurisdiction over the code and changes to the code. And so that the way that we would be looking at the presidential task force is that this would be more input, just like we're getting input from lots of people all over the community, this would be input, but that it's our jurisdiction. So I think it can work. It's just a matter, I think, of being clear, as people are, that we have jurisdiction over that. But there are also the politics of the situation of if there are recommendations coming out of this task force, you know, how do we actually interact with them? But I think all that can be done. But the problem is we keep talking about, going back to now the working group, we don't have a working group yet. We have certain people who have been identified and been approved. We don't have an employee member. I think we should ask ourselves, do we want to ask the employee assembly to suggest two people so that we have, you know, two employees? That would seem like at least a fix. And the other thing that I think that we should do, and I don't know how polite you're being with them, that, but is to just say, here's our deadline, for when we'd like for you to have the people who you want from your constituency. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're already doing that, but I think that has to be quite soon. And I think that before everybody leaves for the winter break, the working group has to meet at least once and sit down and put together a timeline and say, this is when our forums will take place. This is what we will publicize so people know. So I think a lot of it is getting out to the public that we're actually working in a well-organized fashion.
Thank you. And I will relay that to Connor. And as much as I'm trying to say at the CJC level, let the working group operate, if it comes down to it, I will, at the very least, email everyone involved in this whole committee as well. And we could have a super meeting on another day to, at the very least, hash that. Well, that will be the sole item of business, at the very least, to ensure that something is done. Again, family matters happen, and that is, again.
No, I'm not blaming you.
No.
That's
I would,
not the only thing. It's been kind of dragging on like this for a while.
Absolutely.
We just have to take control of it.
Yes, I agree.
We can do that.
Yes. So next we're out of time, but we have David and then Nate and then Gabe. If we keep them brief, because I know that a lot of people have 6 o'clock commitments, myself included. So
I'll be brief. So back when I worked as a pharmacist, when a rude resident wanted his medication now for his patient in the ICU, the answer was, do you want it now or do you want it right? And my question for this conversation is, do we want to do it well with thoughtful debate and do it right once, or have it pushed through because of a political agenda and just have it something on paper so it has to be redone over and over and over again for the next 2 years, right? And so my question is there a political push for this, or is there a functional push for this? If it's functional and something needs to be done because there's something pressing, then fine. If it's a political push, I say we have patience and we do it right. We get the right people on the committee, we take our time, we don't lag on it, but we do it well.
Thank you. That's in terms of doing it well. I think this committee is very much, that's our objective. I think it's very important that we keep that in mind. It's also why we've, again, pushed the timeline further out, because it's just, you need that committee input. Next is Nate, then we'll wrap up with Gabe.
Yeah, so I think on the other hand, the issue is that if we don't, you know, if we worry too much about, you know, perfect is the enemy of good enough, and we do want an outcome, I think there is a non-political reason for us to move with speed, deliberate speed, which is that the community has cried out for change, and that the UA, which governs this body, has tasked this body with doing that. So I don't think it's just the politics, and I think that we can stay firm about our relationship with the task force, with the presidential task force, without dragging our heels. I'm very, very, very worried about the idea of dissolving the ad hoc and bringing it back into the CJC, because from where I sit, all of the delay that's happened so far has been within the CJC because the ad hoc hasn't done anything. I don't think that's Connor's fault, and I don't think it's the fault of the ad hoc. I think the problem is that it hasn't been clear who's on it, you know, when it meets, and all of that. And I think that part of that has also been our occasional failure to couch the actions of the committee and the ad hoc and its identity formally and broadcast them to the community. So I would make a motion that sometime by the end of, let's say by close of business tomorrow, that Matt sends an email to Connor and the rest of the people who have currently been appointed to the ad hoc, basically saying, you're authorized, go, we want a meeting, at least one meeting before the next CJC meeting, which you can give us something. That's my motion, that the CJC calls for the current people who are on the ad hoc to meet at least once before the next CJC meeting.
Michelle.
When's the next CJC meeting?
That'd be the Wednesday after Thanksgiving. So in terms of scheduling for business, that gives us tomorrow and Friday, which is questionable. Then you have the next 2 days after, 2 days before Thanksgiving, which is, you mentioned before, not many people are here. And then you, in essence, would have Monday and Tuesday after the break, and as well as Wednesday before 4:30. So
point of information.
Yes.
So the people on the committee currently are you, and Connor.
And then Aaron Ells. There we go.
Okay, so others have started to.
Yes, so the GPSA. Richard.
Okay, so.
Is second.
Is there a second to that motion?
Second.
There's a second.
Can I get the exact language?
The language is that.
Actually, we're really running out of time. Who wouldn't mind us confirming?
Okay, yeah. We'll do that.
So we had Gabe on the speakers list. Richard had a point of information, or?
No.
So in that case, there's a motion, there's a second.
Is this just a motion to send an email?
By tomorrow. So
Is that a dissent discussion or?
I wanted to talk to the motion.
Okay. Well, in that case, Richard, then reset on the motion.
So if the ad hoc committee were up and working and actually meeting, this would be a good thing. I agree with Nate that some of the circumstances, failure to appoint, the employee people appointing their members and so forth, and the dean of faculty, which is paradoxical since he was complaining about us not moving. You know, those things are, they're out of control of the ad hoc committee, but they're not going to hold water when we're trying to make the process legitimate as if we're doing something. That's my, so aside from all, if we can't get this committee up and working because of whatever reasons there are, I think it should come back here so we can do something. That is the point. We can't wait for continued failures to act.
Thank you. Next is Risa.
I like the sentiment. I just don't think that it's practical with what you suggested, Nate. But I think, to go back to what I suggested before, I don't know that I needed as a motion, is for Matt to make every effort possible to really put pressure on the constituencies to say, here's who we are appointing, because then we'll have a committee. And then right after that happens, and before people meet for the, before people leave for the semester, we can have a meeting and really set out an agenda. But I think that since one of the reasons we're having this committee with lots of constituents on it and open to the public is to be transparent, have everybody be able to participate, that we need to have a committee put together so it meets as a full committee rather than as a partial committee that makes decisions that should be made as a whole committee with the community involved. So I think that the first order of business needs to be to actually get a committee put together, publicize it, and publicize when it will meet, and then get going on that.
Thank you. Next is Sarah, then, oh no, pardon me, next is Nate, then Sarah, then Anna.
I really agree with that sentiment.
That's fine.
Okay. I think I'd be in support of that. I just think it's like kind of unnecessarily bureaucratic because like we have to go over what their suggestion is and then the UA has to, and we're trying to do this on a timeline. So maybe I would suggest like if they can't get it together, like, and have a meeting by our next meeting, then we could just charge ourselves with it. Because I feel like if we wait long enough, then it's just going to fall by the wayside.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? Anna's next. Is there anyone else who wants to speak for this motion? Okay, next.
Actually, I think I'm next.
Oh, you're, yeah. Sorry, no, sorry, Nate. Apologize.
So,
and Jeremy.
I don't. So the point is that the community wants us to do something, and the community wants to be involved in that. And so I think that trying to dissolve the ad hoc when we've already started to get community buy-in would really remove all legitimacy, all of our legitimacy from the eyes of the community. So I'm fine with waiting a little bit to get people from all of the constituencies, but they know about us, and so I think, we can't. All right, sorry, let me organize my thoughts a little bit here. So one thing is that the whole reason that we wanted to make an ad hoc is because this committee is busy. We are busy, and we're not even getting to the last two items on our agenda today, running almost 15 minutes late. I have zero confidence that unless we drop everything else that you and the rest of us have planned for this entire academic year, that we will be able to address this issue in the CJC at all this academic year. I don't see where the time physically is unless we start meeting. We're already meeting twice as often as we normally meet, apparently. So, unless we start meeting two or three times a week, I just don't see it happening. So I think this has to be in some group of people that has community involvement that is tasked to come back and give the CJC something, and that's the ad hoc. And so I don't think we should dissolve it before we give it the chance to actually do anything. So maybe the imperative thing is just to get reps from the other constituent assemblies, post-haste, give them a deadline and tell them. Yes, you do. I'm sorry. I'm agreeing. Yes. But it might be worth posing a deadline and saying, you have to give us reps by X time. We're going to be up and running. We're going to be meeting. Your people can join us when you have them for us. But there is urgency to this matter.
So in terms of that, the Faculty Senate currently have a list of names. They actually are going to be, they are very advanced in their process. The Student Assembly I can stop by their meeting on Thursday to explicitly notify them. The employees that I met today, actually I had an exam, so I couldn't attend. But Jeremy is the executive vice chair of the EA, so I'm sure you were getting all this.
Sure, we have discussed it. I just now received another recommendation. Mm-hmm. Had one other that we were going to contact. Mm-hmm. But we don't know if that person is even interested. So it's a matter of making the contacts mm-hmm. and getting the confirmation. If there is a second slot available, I need to know that so that I can mm-hmm. Charge it to the exec committee to fill that position.
Okay, so and going on to answer the speaker's list, two questions. One, and you're, and I know the SA is able to move quickly if they wish to. Are you interested? Are you think you get someone to us by? And as next, do you think we get someone bus by like say Thanksgiving? And two, if the in essence the slots are the EA can appoint one as a matter of right, so to speak, and the other one would be our slot. So in essence, we would come to us and we would certainly just rubber stamp and say okay, yes. Mm-hmm. So in essence, if the committee is interested in doing that, we can do that as well.
Just like rubber stamp it now.
We certainly could.
So we won't have a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, just like let them do too.
Yes, we can do that.
Great.
So in that case, next is
okay. Anna. I will address that then. And we will. I can't guarantee a time frame at the moment because I need
of
to
course.
Talk to
no, absolutely.
Committee, but the urgency is understood.
Understood. Thank you. Next is Anna, and then actually Jeremy again.
As it sounds like we are beginning to figure out timelines for actually getting the full constituency onto this ad hoc, I can't make motions, but I would suggest that the ad hoc, as it meets, as it stands at whatever point, meet by Skype if necessary before our next meeting, knowing that they won't have the full committee yet, but just to lay out a timeline. That does not necessarily impede community input, but it, committee of all.
We wouldn't necessarily need it because it's a matter of whoever's appointed.
But it gives a process so that the minute that the committee is fully staffed, it can start moving forward. To the concerns that perhaps the CJC should yank this from the ad hoc back to its own charge, from what I have seen, the delay is on the end of this body, and I realize that is picking a fight. I would, in my role personally, then ask the UA to consider whether we still wanted this here. But that is my own concerns about timeliness.
Understood. And just noting the bylaws require things contained in the code to be under us. Yeah. Next in the speakers is Jeremy.
So a couple of quick things, and I'm going to make this really quick because I would like to go home. the first is I think we need to stick with the ad hoc committee because we want representation outside of this group. We want to hear from some new people. And I think that's important. I think we're doing a good job of it. It is taking a bit longer than maybe some of us hoped to get it done, but I think we can have positive action there. We should. The second is the timeline. We have had words from the president herself who says her task force is going to be reaching out and interacting with us. We haven't had any of that yet because they're not up on their feet yet. So our timeline is not quite as fast, I think, as some folks are thinking, because I think we do want to have that interaction with the presidential task force in that making those decisions, because I think there's a lot of good information that's going to come from that direction as well. So I hesitate to try to come to a resolution before we've made that contact and gathered that information. I understand that does add an additional delay. But again, back to the point of do we want to do it faster, or do we want to do it right? I think we want to do it right, and part of that is using the best resources that we have available to us.
Thank you. I have Gabe and Richard on the speakers list of the motion, noting that we are still running, and I have allowed us to run over time. I would ask that people move quickly, and that we, in essence, if we need to extend, I can be slightly late to my class, but that means that we do have, I know people have commitments, and respecting that. So next would be Gabe and then Richard.
Yeah, so a lot of people know that I usually don't mince words. Like, as the minutes say, I, chastise the people for not showing up last week. And, but honestly, that's pretty much been my only concern. Like, otherwise, aside from not showing up sometimes, I think the committee's done, a really good job. I think, we spent time figuring out how to structure the working group. We debated about the structure of the working group. Then we figured out, then now we have charged the working group with assembling itself. You know, we have four assemblies that have to like coordinate to appoint people, and like that's really hard. So I'm not too worried. Like the president of the university, which like has the unilateral ability to just appoint people, still hasn't done it either. And so like the fact that we are even remotely keeping pace is actually, the way I see it, kind of impressive. In terms of like moving forwards, I think that it's okay. I think we should tell Connor, like, come on, man, send an email. Here are the people who's on it. Like, send an email, Skype, start doing it. But like, I also have like talked with him, and like, I know that there's something that, you know, that's kind of personal going on with him, and like, that sucks. But I think that should probably resolve itself soon. So I think that I'm not too worried. I don't think, you know, we're going to walk out the door and the world's not going to blow up. Like, everything's going to still be here tomorrow. So I don't think there's a catastrophe. I think that, you know, we're moving at a pretty good pace. You know, we're meeting like twice as much as normal. So I think overall I'd say I'm in a good place. I don't think that we've really made any huge mistakes.
Thank you, Gabe. Next up is Richard.
So very brief. I'm happy with this discussion because what I wanted to do was build a fire, and you know, I think we've built a fire. So let it burn. I agree with Gabe. It's not a conflagration yet, and I don't want it to be, but I do want that fire. I would note one thing. If this ad hoc committee doesn't get up and running, we're going to be spending every session here dealing with this, whether or not we bring the ad hoc committee back. We're not going to save time. If this ad hoc committee doesn't work, it's going to be in our lap. So this is, I really want them to take it. But, you know, if they don't, it's going to be in our lap anyway.
Thank you. That exhausts the speakers list. We are well over time. There is a motion on the table. Even if the motion does not go through, I am more than happy and actually plan to, after hearing the discussion, they will reach out as prerogative as chair, even if the motion passes or not, to the very least to it. Reach out to the assemblies to ensure that they are aware of our timeline. I know Jeremy does, but just again, to ensure that there's a formal record, and then also to reach out to the members of the working group. So at the very least set up a when is good, so that we can at least say, Connor, we have a time, we have a, we did a survey, here's some times that look like they'd work. And again, to at the very least try and assist the process logistically as much as possible to remove any impediments to getting this up and running. So that being said, there is a motion. There is no speakers list. Is there a motion to call a question on said motion? There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any dissent? Hearing none. All those in favor of the motion, actually, would you like to summarize your motion very briefly so we don't really know?
Yeah, motion is for Matt Estrada, the CJC, to email Connor and the current members of the ad hoc to tell them that they're all on it, and I'll add to the motion to set up a Yahoo.
Okay. Would
you do this even if it failed?
I would do this even if it failed, just because it needs to be done. So, Chief Zoner, anything you want to add?
No.
Oh, sorry.
Just voting.
Okay. So in that case, all those in favor of said motion, please raise your hand or placard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. All who are opposed, all would like to abstain. The chair abstains by vote 7-0-2. I will do that.
I will send the email I was going to send anyways.
Yes. Great. So thank you. And we are quite our time. 6:08. Yes. Being adjourned.
I voted for it.
Exactly.
Like I said, that's actually the same. He
can't just call himself.
I've
already
talked
to him. I know
what's going on.
Sorry, we're just going to get a second, by the way.